right, everybody, welcome back to the Crypto 101 podcast. We got a very special guest. Man, this one's going to be exciting. A former CFO of Binance, which is currently, I think, the world's largest exchange for cryptocurrency, but might not be for long. Wei Zhao has since left and is now the CEO and main shareholder of Coins.ph, which is the largest crypto exchange in the Philippines and maybe soon the world. Who knows? Wei, welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Really, thanks for having me here.
Yeah. No, it was funny. Right before the show, I was saying, you know, man, I recognize you because I saw you back in 2019 and really in Singapore. Binance had a big conference, and there was, like, you know, the very first time that, like, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried kind of came out and launched Alameda, and, you know, so we go back.
Yeah, that was, if you remember, that was like the dead of the bear market. That was literally like
dead of the bear market.
It was the sort of, like, the world was like, crypto has ended, ETH is like under 100. Crypto was dead, right?
Substratum was shorting Ethereum with their treasury at $80.
Pretty much, yeah. And then I had joined Binance in the summer of 2018, so I was a little bit sheltered, I think, from sort of the market crashing, I think, from like second half of 17. And then my role there was I basically built up the investment business there, so sort of led a lot of the M&A, and then sort of also started building up the fiat business there. So, like, my title was a CFO, but it was more of like a, what I call like a growth CFO rather than an accounting CFO.
Yeah. I mean, what's the statistic about Binance? Was it the fastest company to $1 billion in profit ever, or the fastest to $1 billion valuation?
I think the word that I would use, organization, because the company concept, I don't think was really preached from day one. But as an organization, I think they built a bunch of stuff, right? I think, you know, they built, and they introduced a lot of people in the developing world, I think, into crypto. So, it's kind of,
yeah, they really are, you know, an international powerhouse, and, they do a lot of work internationally with charities, as well as just onboarding, all sorts of different, you know, fiat currencies into crypto. So, love what they're doing. And I'm excited to hear about kind of your journey that led you to be the CEO of Coins.ph, again, one of the largest or the largest exchange in the Philippines. Tell us about this move. What made you want to jump from being the CFO at Binance to this new venture?
Yeah, sure. So I left Binance in the summer of 2021. And then after I left, I think it took some time to basically decompress and chill out and then sort of, like, return to reality, you know, coming.
Like, yeah, coming after the crazy price moves of 2021.
Yeah, it was 2021 was a good year, right? So, yeah. And at that point, there was, Coins had been owned 100% by an Indonesian ride-hailing company called Gojek, right? Mm-hmm. And then Gojek wanted to divest out of Philippines and divest out of sort of, like, you know, payment crypto altogether and focus on Indonesia, which is their home market, and the core business, which is ride-hailing e-commerce. So there was they wanted to spin it off. And then I had known about Coins for a bit because, when I was at Binance, I was actually doing global expansion and then, global acquisition of basically exchanges and building up fiat and building up licensed businesses around the world. So I had known about it. And then I had known about Philippines as well, just because, you know, it was actually one of the hottest countries, you know, globally in terms of crypto adoption, in terms of NFT adoption, in terms of Web3 gaming. So mm-hmm. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, like a Venn diagram of like a cool country, lots of people, massive opportunity in terms of adoption, and clear and transparent regulation on crypto, mm-hmm. right? And there's a licensed business that has licensed not just in cryptocurrency exchange from the central bank, but also it's an e-wallet. So it's kind of like a Venmo plus a Coinbase plus a remittance plus like a Western Union, because it has a West remittance business as well. Mm-hmm. So we're basically hitting at a country that has already, you know, pretty good adoption, but potential use case wise, like, people have been talking about remittance, but here it is, Philippines, the fourth biggest remittance intaking country in the world, right? And then we can actually, right, you know, put crypto rails into it, right? At the same time, it's also, like, you know, the biggest Web3 gaming country in the world. And then, you know, they need fiat on ramps and off ramps, right? They need to basically get the money in. What if they earn money playing games and they get that money out and spend it? So we had this up, and it also, you know, already has a 10 plus million registered user base, has about, you know, a couple of million, you know, about 5 million sort of like, you know, monthly active users in its app. So I thought like, this is an amazing opportunity for us to basically, you know, buy at that point, basically, you know, to buy it out of Gojek and then basically, you know, build it up, right? Take, and then what I call basically, you know, use Philippines as, I wouldn't even call it a proof of concept, but basically build a successful use cases, right? Build successful business, new business models, and then basically figuring out if we can replicate that in other regions, right? All of that, meanwhile, doing all of that under a licensed and regulated environment. I think that's something that a lot of people have talked about, but I don't think anyone's sort of really dabbled into, just because I think, you know, people from sort of, I would say, the unregulated world tend to have difficulties operating in a regulated environment, right? It's like saltwater and fresh. You're a saltwater fish, you know, you're trying to do it. It's really hard for you to become a freshwater fish overnight, right? So I think that's sort of like, and I took on opportunity, and then we finished, and I partnered up with an acquisition firm called Joffrey. And we basically bought out Gojek stake, and we got regulatory approval March of last year. So we're coming on the 1 year sort of like, you know, 1 year point in terms of the deal. So that's sort of like the backstory in terms of how we came upon it. And then I sort of like, you know, and then, you know, they trusted me enough to have enough experience in the industry to basically fund me. And then, you know, I obviously put some personal capital into the business as well. And then I took on the CEO role for about a year now at CoinsPH.
Love it. Now, I really do want to focus, you know, I guess the first part of the conversation on that regulation. Just because, you know, I'm over here in the States, a lot of our audience is in the States, but, you know, we do have a good chunk that's in Asia and Europe as well. And regulation for crypto is obviously different literally every single country you go in. And it seems like, you know, the West has been pretty resistant to a lot of like, you know, the Bitcoin ETF and a lot of this stuff. And some countries in Asia have been a lot more friendly, like the Philippines, for example. Like the fact that you could have this all in one business, it's perfect. It, you know, it's moving great. You know, you've got a great relationship with regulators. Like that's really not a story that's ever told from like a builder of an exchange in America. Why is that? What's the big difference between building an exchange in America versus elsewhere?
I think it's so sort of when I was looking at it, I mean, I learned a lot of this during my time at Binance. It's like, I think people talk about East West, but I think in crypto is actually global North versus global South. It's basically the have countries versus the have not countries. And the have countries, they basically have already an established, like it's basic. I mean, I don't want to point fingers specifically to the US because it's probably true in some of the other, you know, more developed countries as well, is that they have incumbents to protect, or they have, not even to protect, they have incumbents that are quite, that have sort of like, they see the same thesis behind Bitcoin and blockchain, right? Except they come at it to be like, I need to protect my future from this. they come at it completely from a different angle. And these are the have countries, right? And that's where we see much stronger resistance from the top down, right? Whereas I think in the global South, and these are not quote unquote have not countries, but these are just basically countries that don't have the legacy infrastructure, right? That have, you know, had some chaos, you know, with its financial system, or just, you know, people are, because I think fundamentally, I think what I find globally at the working level, as sort of like the sort of the normal people are generally interested in this new technology and they want to try it out and they want to use it and they want to figure out how to own it, right? But the thing is that if you have sort of like a big, if you have sort of like, you know, government on top saying, hey, this thing is bad, evil, and scary, people just tend to run away from it, right? But I think in the developing countries, one, you don't really have like incumbents, right, that are sitting at top basically, you know, dictating the future of the financial system, right? That's one. And two, the risk of people sort of like the risk appetite may be a little bit different as well, just because it's a much younger population, right? If you look at the Philippines per se, you know, half the population are under the age of 30, right? That's massive.
Wow. Right? That's incredible. Yeah,
that's like, it's got like one of the most beautiful, like, demographic bell curves you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in these countries where there's like a much larger, younger audience, and the sort of the financial incumbents are not as established and are not as powerful, then basically crypto can take shape in a much more organic way, right? And practical way. I think that's the word that I would use in terms of describing regulation, I think, in Southeast Asian country. That's not just the Philippines. That's in Thailand. That's in Indonesia. And you're kind of seeing it in Australia is actually a pretty clear example. There's actually, you know, five or six, I would say, not thriving, but five or six exchanges down there. And they all work with banks in a pretty transparent way, right? And that's just because they've had you know, a registration system for national exchanges down there since like 2016, 17. And then it's been worked and nobody's really come down to be like, blah, 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 blah. Right. Because I think to operate in a regulated world, you know, in any business, you need two things. You need what I call, you need transparency. Like I need to know what the rules are and I need certainty and I need to know that rules aren't going to, you know, go left and right depending on sort of, you know, whatever results happen. Right. Like these two things, that's how you need to operate a business. Right. And the fact that sort of like, you know, Philippines have come out with what they call VASPs, virtual asset service provider. They have VASP regulations. The previous iteration is called virtual currency exchange, VCE. They've had sort of, you know, rules regulating cryptocurrency exchanges since 2016. Right. So it's sort of like the rules have been around. They may sort of play around with the edges depending on sort of, you know, what global players do. But what behind these rules, you can actually operate a licensed business. Because like my regulator is the same as the banking regulator, so I'm regulated by the central bank, the BSP. These are the same guys that regulate the EMIs, the e-wallets, and the banks. Then it's actually, you know, obviously there are banks that still don't bank crypto in Southeast Asia, but there are certain banks that do bank it, and that has been a pretty healthy relationship. So I think it's just basically like the Global South, I think in general, have been much more practical with crypto. And mainly the other big thing that I find is sort of like, if you look at sort of what's going on in Singapore, is just that when you have like a wealthy country, the government's much more about protecting the wealth. But if you're coming from like, you know, like a low GDP per capita country, then it's more about creating wealth. So I think when people look at crypto and they see this, you know, new technology that can actually create wealth for its population, then there's less, I would say, you know, less hurdles vis-a-vis sort of like, you know, North America per se.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it makes me, it kind of reminds me of like the telecom industry in Africa, for instance. Mm-hmm. And it basically, there's no cable that's laid in Africa. There's no like telephone wires. They went straight to wireless. Like everybody has mm-hmm. a cell phone, even if they don't have a job, mm-hmm. but you know, they do. And that was unheard of, like in America. Like America started with wired because the incumbents had laid cable, right? And so there was a little bit of resistance to cell phone adoption. And Africa leapfrogged, right? And so I think that they're going to leapfrog from barter, which they're basically on right now. And then there's going to be the gap of like, they're not going to have like our same credit card sort of infrastructure, but they're going to leapfrog straight to crypto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like, that's like pretty similar to what I lived in China from 2005 to 2016-ish. And mm-hmm. then basically what you saw is like China completely bypassed PC and laptop, went straight to mobile. Right. It went straight to mobile. Like people still use laptop for work, but nobody will bust out a laptop and like, you know, and watch videos on it. Right. It's all done on mobile. Right. Mm-hmm. Nobody really plays, you know, there's some hardcore games where people went straight to mobile in terms of gaming and daily use. Right. So that's why I think like, you know, there's the it's sort of similar. Right. I think the infrastructure is being built.
And there probably wasn't a huge amount of resistance from the incumbents of Chinese PC makers. Right. Because they were all in the States. Exactly. And that's why the States had a little bit more resistance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's like when there's nothing there, when there's like, you know, just like a barren field, it's much easier to develop versus if you have sort of like, you know, like already the rails and you're basically an alternative to the existing rails. So,
totally. No, that's spot on.
I think that's sort of the bigger philosophical question. I think sort of like the practical answer is that, when we talk to the regulators, I think they read the same articles that we do. I mean, but the thing is they have their network, right? Our network is the crypto sort of like the bro network, and their network is sort of like, you know, the regulator network. Right. And obviously I think they're going to be there. I'm very cautious about sort of the trickle down effect from the US right? Because at the end of the day, a lot of the other regulators in the world in different jurisdictions still look up to the US, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think that, you know, with a sort of, I would say, more crypto-friendly regime in Europe and in the UK, right? With FCA, sort of, if the US is like the big dog, and FCA sort of like, you know, the UK is sort of like the next, you know, and the EU is like, if they come down, you know, if they copy what the US did, then I think, you know, that's kind of like a depressing future. But if they provide an alternative, which I sort of see possible happening, then I think, you know, the rest of the world can have sort of like, they can choose, you know, which direction, or they can sort of just choose to stay doing what they're doing. Right.
Yeah. But and it does seem like there is some court cases that are being fought. I mean, literally, the SEC is getting sued by Grayscale right now for blocking the spot ETF, but they granted the futures ETF. And so I think that, you know, there's going to be some court precedent that could, you know, maybe get some more friendly crypto regulation. I know that Coinbase was in the Supreme Court literally today talking about some stuff. Ripple, you know, they're going to get a resolution here. So, you know, there could be some, hopefully some positive pushback.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, like, if you look at US, that's why it's a tricameral system, right? Or whatever. There's the balance of power, right? You have SEC and all these like regulators, they all sit under the executive branch, right? If there's no congressional action, we also have the courts, right? Right. In the US, right? Like, the courts is like, if there's no congressional action on the on new rules, then the interpretation of the existing rules aren't actually solely sit in the jurisdiction of the executive branch, right? Actually go to the judicial branch to basically get interpretations on existing laws and existing rules and regulations, right? Pending sort of, you know, Congress passing new laws and regulations, which is, I think, what we're looking for, or, you know, I think the industry looking for. But I think it doesn't seem like anything's going to happen on that side.
Damn it.
Anyhow.
Where do you think we're at right now in terms of, you know, the market cycle? You think we're, you know, you could take it from a macro standpoint, looking at where we're at, maybe this flood of liquidity in the markets right now from the Fed and PBOC and BOJ, everybody's printing right now. Where do you think we're at in the market cycle?
Yeah. I think, like, one thing that's really neat is that crypto is like sort of like our marketplace, given that it trades 24/7, given it's actually, you know, the world is actually linked into it, right? It's not like equity. It's like sort of like separate pools of capital, right, that trades with each other. This is actually the truest form of like global liquidity, all trading, you know, one single asset class 24/7.
Totally.
We are actually like the leading indicator. Bitcoin, yeah, big time. Like sort of what happened in 2021 and 2022 when the Fed, before even Fed started hiking rates, sort of like Bitcoin was the first to go, right? I mean, from 65 all the way down to whatever. And then crypto was the first to go, right? And then obviously there was sort of like, you know, what I call like in-house issues we had to deal with as an industry, right? In terms of the frauds, in terms of the, you know, the leverage, in terms of sort of like the massive deleveraging event that we saw last summer. I think we're seeing that in the traditional financial system now, because everything is about deleveraging, right? And then duration mismatch. And it's basically, you know, you got a bunch of people wanting to withdraw their capital and then found out that, hey, I can't withdraw my capital for whatever reason, right? I
feel like, like, that's never fun.
Like, didn't we add that in the crypto world from, you know, and from
we've had that so many times,
right? Do we have that? Like, and then it got replayed here, right? And then, but what I really like about crypto is that we solved that with market, right? Without any interference from third party, right? And then we realized that, hey, the centralized lending platforms are the dangerous ones. Let's get it off of the centralized platforms, right? And then get self-custody, right? I think that was the biggest takeaway for all new crypto players in 2022, like the importance of self-custody. And then we're seeing that being replayed, I think, in the banking system today. It's like instead of sort of like allocating your, you know, like what I call, like, instead of allocating quote unquote, percentage of your portfolio to crypto or to Bitcoin, you should allocate a percentage of your wealth to self-custody. And if that happens, then I think we're going to have it won't be just like sort of like, you know, hot money chasing crypto. I think we're going to have like a structural shift in terms of like actually just individuals, right? Like, and like not just rich individuals, but actually just plain old individuals wanting to custody their own wealth, right, wanting to custody their own assets. And the first thing they're going to look at, I think, is Bitcoin, right? Just because it's something that everybody knows. And the next thing they're going to look at is maybe Ethereum, right? Because what does Bitcoin give you? Bitcoin gives you sort of safety and self-custody, right? And what does Ethereum give you? I think with liquid staking, with the Shanghai upgrade coming up, it gives you yield, right? A liquid yield, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't matter if it's 2%, 3%, it's like 5% right now, but maybe go down, but maybe go up, right? But and a almost like a deflationary way, right? I think combination of these two things, I think it's setting us up really well for the industry, right? I think last year was really painful, and then you start seeing what I call, like even second half of last year prior to FTX, I think we were seeing like what I call like, you know, green shoots, right? Things right. were actually looking up in November prior to the FTX collapse. Right? Mm-hmm. And I think you know what? We digested that. We got poorer because of it, but we survived and we moved on, right? Like literally like nobody's really even talking about FTX, and that was only 4 months ago, right?
Can I ask you, I mean, candidly about that whole thing, because obviously you and CZ are like, you know, acquaintances, buddies, friends. I don't know your relationship, but you worked with him for a long time. And he was really calling out Sam Bankman-Fried for all the fraud and, you know, looked at the deal for 24 hours and turned away. And people are saying there was a little bit of a fight. He's saying it's not a fight. What was just your perspective during the whole thing?
I'm probably going to get quoted on this, but I thought I went into a movie because I'm a spectator in all of this, right? I have some assets on both platforms, but mainly I'm a spectator in this, right? I thought I was going to watch The Clash of the Titans, right?
Right.
And that's the movie that I thought I paid for, right? This is the movie that I thought I was going to watch. But I ended up watching Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. So that was my takeaway.
Fair. So
that was my experience, and then you know how paper tiger FTX and Sam was, right? Yeah. That you know, like I don't think CZ did much. CZ just said, "Hey, I don't think their books are clean."
Basically,
right?
Yeah.
But that's it. That's all he said, right? But the problem, but I think the issue there is I think it comes down to sort of like CZ has massive amount of influence in the industry. Right. And then he has never publicly said, "I'm selling something" before. He's always been a permeable, right? He's always buying, but he is always about buying, building, and holding, right? Yes. Like even with Luna, he's like, "Oh, it was worth $1 billion in our portfolio. Now it's worth nothing," right? We never sold a dime, right? But the thing is, he's like FTT was the first token, sort of in my memory, and BSV was the other one, right? that Binance did in 2018, right? But sort of this was not the first token that but he never said sell. He just said, "We're just delisting it." Right. But then this is like the first token where he publicly went on social media and actually said, "I'm selling." Right. Mm-hmm. And if FTX was, you know, custody 1-to-1, then it wouldn't have been a problem. Right. But it wasn't. Right. And that's like, you know, that was the problem. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe he knew something we didn't. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he just wanted to sort of like, you know, just sort of like poke the tiger a little bit. I don't think he even realized sort of the totality of the fraud.
Right. Yeah. I don't think anybody really knew how bad it was. And I think Sam Bankman-Fried got pretty cocky. And I remember there was this one tweet that he said, like, "Oh, is CZ even allowed in Washington, D.C.? Like, snicker, snicker." And I think that probably set CZ off a little bit because it's like, hey, like, that's just like it's a really rude thing to say and it's not necessarily true. And of course, like, Sam Bankman-Fried was buying up all this D.C. power and spreading his own truth. And he was basically corrupting the minds of all these politicians with what his truth was. And he was painting this picture. That was probably why CZ was getting a lot of regulatory flack and stuff, because Sam Bankman-Fried spent billions of dollars building up that notion that anybody that wasn't FTX was a bad guy.
Yeah, and I don't think it was just political influence; it was media influence as well.
Totally
right. I think he probably just realized an arbitrage that he could have in terms of basically shaping how people think, and then how decisions are made, and then how policies are made, and then I think he just sort of short-tracked that. Short-circuited that, and then basically, you know, like got a lot of, you know, got built a, I think built just build something that around, build a certain image, build a certain notion of, you know, what it is. And then, and in short, I mean, I think my takeaway is that my takeaway from that whole fiasco is just sort of like, you know, like we're here to build a trustless society. Right. We're not here to, cause you tend to do that, I think, in tech. I think human emotion tend to do that. You know, we always wanted to believe in something bigger than us. Like, we always wanted to believe, like, that's, you know, that's why cults exist, right? That's why religion exists, right? We always wanted to believe there is the all knowing, right? Like, up until last week, you know, Fed played that role. they were like, you know, they were, right? Like, you know, right. Whoever the governor was, you followed his every single word because that was the Bible, and the, you know, that is the Bible of the financial universe, right?
Right.
But hey, we're all, at the end of the day, you realize we're all just humans, right? Like,
we're all human.
Yeah, exactly. I think they more than blinked.
they're still closing their eyes. They're just like still eyes closed.
No. I just sort of like, I describe it as like a deer in the headlights look. Like, literally, they like, when, like, if you watch their testimonies in front of Congress, literally, when a hard question comes and they're not prepared for it, it's that deer in the headlight look, and it is scary to see.
Yeah, you see Yellen's testimony the other day. She was asked by, I think it was a Oklahoma senator or something, about all the regional bank deposits, and she's like fluttering around, like, no, she has no idea what she's enacted or the limits of it. You know, it's all staging.
Yeah. That's why I think we're here to build a, you know, a trustless, you know, encoded world, right? I think that's something that I think is like, it's easier to understand, I think, if you're younger, but I think if you're older, it's like, it's not ageism or anything. It's just tough, just because that's not the world you grew up in. Right. Like, for example, like, you know, like, get a little bit personal here, but like, my daughter is, she's 6.5 years old. And then her favorite content to consume up until last year were, like, you know, Paw Patrol and Octonauts and stuff. But about last year, she started watching Minecraft videos.
No, yeah, there you go. Those are popular.
That is her favorite content right now. Right. And like, it's just like, and they're she's going to understand metaverse like way differently than me or than anybody. Yeah. Than someone who's like probably like, you know, 5 to 10 years even older than her. Right. So I think that's just, you know, just I think things are, the pace of change, I think, is increasing as well. Right. So, yeah, like last year was like all metaverse, and this year was just AI, right? So
yeah. You were you'd mentioned I saw an article the other day about your argument of hyper tokenization versus hyper Bitcoinization, and how you think there's probably more of a tokenization kind of upswing that kind of catches fire. Is that because of this metaverse and NFTs, or is this kind of a different concept?
I think it's use cases. I think it's almost like I don't know if you read or follow sort of Balaji Srinivas's like network state. I think it's sort of like we're building a new, almost like a new virtual society, right? And then what do you need in a society? You need monetary exchange, right? And then all of us are plugged in here. Like, I never in the history of the world have, like, humans, like, just, like, this is something that I kind of like, you know, I'm going to quote CZ on this. It's like, humans have never really had financial freedom before. And this is what we're here to deliver. What is financial freedom? To be able to custody and spend and use your own money in your, like, without a third party, right? Without going through intermediaries, right? With wallets, now that's like, there's, you know, there's a ton of wallets being built. And I think wallet is going to be the gateway that basically humans are going to connect with each other, and we can actually transact and trade with each other.
Right? Yeah, it'll be like the new web browser.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is the browser, right? Like, it is the new browser, like, browser, but the browser, you basically can get and upload and interact, right? But that's just information, right? The transaction layer, the commerce layer are still dominated by credit cards and traditional financial systems and banks, right? But crypto sort of bypasses all of that, right? Like, you can actually start transacting, right? And then what are you going to transact first? Obviously products that are native to that environment, right? Basically digital assets. What are digital NFTs, right? It is NFT. And that's what's the really interesting part. That's why I'm actually really excited about not just sort of ETH NFTs, but actually Bitcoin ordinal NFTs. Because for the first time, other than Bitcoin Lightning, you actually have a use case on Bitcoin, on the Bitcoin network now, right? So, and that's really exciting, right? Just because you can actually have, you know, Because but any society, obviously, you need storage of value. You need to sort of like, you know, like you need to have, you know, consistency in terms of how things are quoted, right? Mm-hmm. And up until today, all tokens are all still kind of quoted in dollar terms, right? But not NFTs. NFTs is the first sort of like, you know, Web3 digital native asset that's quoted in its native currency, right? ETH. All NFTs are quoted in ETH, right? And that's really powerful, right? Because that's the only way, I think, for us to really get off. And I think get off sort of like the dollar quoting system, right?
Yeah.
And the order of NFTs are going to be quoted in BTC, right? People have been trying to get things quoted in BTC, but the volatility nature of it sort of takes us out of it. But hey, NFTs are quoted in ETH, right? In the bull market, NFTs are going to like go pump like crazy because you get not just the ETH appreciation, you also get the natural sort of like, you know, prime real estate and Manhattan kind of evaluation, right? Obviously, in the bull market, it's going to underperform 2x as well because there's going to be less to, you know, ETH is going to like, you know, that's what we saw last year, right? But in the upswing, I think, you know, we're ready for that. So what I mean by sort of like hyper-tokenization, I just think that NFT obviously is a type of token, right? I think there's going to be tons and tons of more of type of digital assets that's going to get printed, right? Not printed, but get tokenized, right? And that could be NFTs, that could be actually, you know, underlying tokens. And then what I hope for is, especially you're seeing sort of layer two stuff coming out now, all of the assets on there are going to be probably denominated in ETH, right? And as ETH becomes sort of like the underlying quoting currency, and then we're moving into sort of, we're moving one step closer. Right. Because like if you play any games, right, you're going to know that, you know, all the gaming assets in there are quoted in rubies or gold coins or diamonds. Right. 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 And that's kind of the world that we're going into. Right. But in, you know, but with, you know, real value per se. Right. So, yeah, that's what I meant by that. Yeah.
No, I love it. And at Coins, at Coins, are you guys going to have non-custodial components, or is it all centralized? Basically, how would we take the lessons that we learned from the collapse in 2022 and make a better exchange?
Yeah. So for us, obviously, we are that's the funny thing is we get audited by our, like, what is it? Like our wallets get audited by our regulators on a quarterly basis. And they come in and not, they don't, it's like I was a CFO for 15, 20 years, right? And then when I ran audits, what PwC or the big four auditing exchanges, like I'll tell you this sort of like, this is why I'm like in love with crypto. And that's why I think it's, if regulators will just open their eyes, it's actually like a, it's amazing. and like, you know, when I was a CFO in China, like what they do is the big four auditing agencies, they would send a letter, right, to the bank. Right? And to say, this company has given us permission for you to disclose their bank balance to me. I'm an auditor, right? So for the full year audit, the banks would basically list out the bank accounts and the balances that the company has at their bank, right? And that's how they audit the cash balance of a bank, of a company, right? Mm-hmm. How outdated is that? It's a physical letter that gets sent to the bank. And then the bank comes back with a physical letter saying, this is how much is your balance. But that's how the process works, right? And what happened in China is that, like, for one company, there's one giant fraud case in the 2010s where they corrupted the branch manager, and the branch manager sent back fake sums of cash balances to, like, PwC, PMG, or whoever, or Deloitte, yeah. And they basically, the balance that they had at the bank was fake. Right,
he like Bernie Madoff, you know, writing in fake arbitrary numbers,
right? But he corrupted the banks to basically be on his side. The company did, right? So that's the old world. That is literally the old world that I left, right? In this world, when I get audited in terms of I'm on a call, right? Because it's a remote, and then I basically have to log in to my wallets and show them the balance in real time. This is my customer balance, right, on the left-hand side, and here's my crypto balance.
Yep,
that's it. That's it.
It's done. You don't have to trust. It's already verified, right?
It's the chain. And this is not a decentralized world I'm describing, right? This is basically, here's my wallet. I'm a centralized exchange. I custody customer assets, right? Mm-hmm. This is the summation of my customers' assets that have deposited or custodied with me. And then this is basically the balance that I have in my cold and hot wallets. and the summation should match.
Here's your assets and here's your liabilities, right? Your customer deposits.
My liabilities. Match real time. Right. And then match. And then I get audited, you know, quarterly. And then maybe they'll do spot checks as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty easy way to get out of the FTX issue. Right. If you have just a regulator comes into their office and be like, open up your accounts, show me all your cold wallets.
Show me what's inside.
Show me what's inside. That's it. Right. And then
I got a question for you.
So let me finish the previous. So that's that's how I think a proper regulation or custody solution should work, right? And they should understand and the agencies should understand how to do that. It's not that hard, right? Yeah. Which gnaws at me. I'd be like, why don't people just sort of be practical about regulating this thing, right? And because even the service providers that a lot of people use are global as well. Whether it's BitGo custody, whether it's Coinbase custody, right? We use BitGo custody. And then whether it's like Fireblocks or Hot Wallet, there's like even the vendors are the same, right? Everybody uses sort of like the same five or six, you know, vendors for different parts of their service offerings, right? So sort of that's sort of like on the centralized side. But on the decentralized side, what we've done at Coins is we actually put a decentralized wallet within our app such that we want our users to be able to move into Web3 or to move into sort of self-custody and decentralized world seamlessly within the Coins app. Sort of that's built. Initially, we've launched a game center. So because I think, you know, like I mentioned before, Philippines is a pretty massive Web3 gaming audience and Web2 as well. So we actually want to, you know, we want our users to be able to go into Web3 games, right? What do you need to play Web3 games? You need a little bit of a game token and you need maybe one or two, a couple of NFTs, right? So we're working with gaming developers to say, hey, if you want to distribute your game to our user base, you know, you're welcome to link to us and then give our users some freebies and then let them play.
Incredible.
Like we'll help you get through the door and get rid of, because the biggest problem with Web3 games right now is actually user acquisition. It's just like, it takes like 10 steps, right? First, buy ETH or buy Matic or buy, you know, whatever. Second, convert that game into NFT.
Oh, it's third, a nightmare.
Log into game, right? And once you made all that money, like good luck getting that out. So for us, we want to sort of make it seamless in terms of how you can actually input, you know, money in. And if you earn money, you can actually take money out and maybe even spend it. And we want to make that all available in the Coins app.
Love that. Man, that's incredible. Is it available to people outside of the Philippines or only in the Philippines?
The app right now, the app is actually, so you have to be, we have to, it's, you know, it's a KYC exchange. But mm-hmm. The app is available in iOS and Android.
Okay. Fantastic.
You can play. Feel free to go to download it, play around with it. I'm not sure. I think without passing KYC, you can't sort of deposit and withdraw. So you can't trade, but you can still play around.
Love it. And then my last question for you, Way, is kind of surrounding some speculation around some changing policy in Hong Kong. I know you said you lived in China and you still probably have ties there. Do you hear any rumblings of some changing policies for maybe institutions or retail traders in Hong Kong?
Yeah. Hong Kong, I think, is what is it? Whether they're being challenged by Singapore or whether they're getting sort of, you know, waking up to Web3 and digital assets. You know, I think a lot of the Chinese exchanges, like the legacy Chinese exchanges, like Huobi, OK, I think they've all had presence in Hong Kong, right? Mm-hmm. Even for Binance, I think there's some activities that they had in Hong Kong when I was there. But the quick answer is yes, and it could be huge. I am doing a lot of research on this. You know, obviously have a ton of contacts there within the industry, but also sort of like within sort of, so the organization that manages cryptocurrency in Hong Kong is the SFC. It's the Securities and Futures Commission, which is interesting because it's basically like if the SFC is like in the US, if the CFTC and SEC merged, you basically get the Hong Kong SFC.
The super regulator.
they regulate all things. So Hong Kong has sort of two main regulators. One is the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, which is like the central bank, right? That regulates all the banks and the EMIs. And then you basically have the SFC, which is basically regulates all the investment banks and the trading. And that's the one that regulates the Hong Kong Stock Exchange as well, right? And what they've done is they basically said, starting June 1st, you can come in and apply for our VASP license that will allow you to not just that will allow you. And because it's SFC, they regulate exchanges. It's actually very specific towards you can actually operate an exchange under this new regulation starting June 1st. Number one.
Wow.
Number two, hey, guess what? This exchange only allows this license, this VASP license allows you to trade utility tokens, right? Yeah. But we will require you to get a type one and type seven, which will allow you to become a dealer and trader of securities as well. Just to have your ass covered in that if you do have potential security issues, like you have a type one and type seven, which basically is a securities broker dealer license or trading license. So they basically want you to be covered 360, like, because we don't know what is securities, what is utility, but let's just get you licensed for all of the above, and then you can run exchange. And then what they're going to regulate on the back end is we will allow for retail to trade on your exchange, but we're going to regulate the tokens, or we're going to monitor and potentially restrict, potentially, you know, check the tokens that the retail users can trade.
I think that's fair. I think that sounds like a pretty good approach.
I think it's actually, once you dig into it, it's probably, it makes a lot of sense. It's like I said, it's practical. I think, but it's going to, and then if you already sort of have business in Hong Kong prior to June 1st, and then we're going to allow you to be grandfathered in to give you 1 year to basically, you know, go through your application process. Right. But the issue is that it is a quote unquote approval based license. It's not a registration based license, if that makes sense. So they need to basically. Yeah. And then also and I think it it's actually quite interesting because they also added, obviously, a lot of the AML, like anti-money laundering things. So they sort of checked that box as well. So it is one of the few regulations that I've seen that actually checks all the boxes, right? And that comes down to, I think, the unique nature of the regulators in Hong Kong is that they do have sort of the securities and futures all sit under one roof, such that, you know, we don't give a crap if it's a commodity or secure, whatever. It's just like, we're just going to cover everything. And then that's going to allow you to run exchange. So I think, and then they obviously have very clear sort of custody requirements, fit and proper requirements for the sort of the owners and the directors. So there's a lot of things that go into it that I actually it just checks all the boxes. So it'll be very interesting to see how it works in the real world. But it is something that I think people in the region are getting super excited about.
Yeah. No, I think people in the region as well as just outside. I mean, a lot of people are starting to talk and speculate on this. And obviously what happens in Hong Kong tends to be a little bit of a proving ground for what happens in Beijing and broader mainland China. So could be some rippling effects. Could be bullish, Wei. Thank you for joining us. This was incredible.
No problem at all. Yep. Staying bullish.
Staying bullish. Holding, building. Man, I hope I can have you on again when you guys have some big announcements or rollouts or whatever. We would love to host you.
Sounds good.
Cool. Take care, and thank you for joining us today.
You know where your business would be without you. Imagine where it could go with more of you. Well, with Wix, you can create a website with more of your vision, your voice, your expertise. Wix gives you the freedom to truly own your brand and do it on your own, with full customization and advanced AI tools that help turn your ideas into reality. Scale up without being held back by cookie-cutter solutions and grow your business into your online brand. Because without you, your business is just business as usual. Take control. Go to Wix.com.
Professionals spend nearly half the work week on written communication, so focus is important. With Grammarly as your AI writing partner, focus and quickly get through work with relevant real-time suggestions. And it works across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can sound more confident and persuasive wherever you write. 93% of professionals report that Grammarly helps them get more work done. Download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast.
As the summer sizzle fades, it's time to establish a wellness routine that's here to stay. Ritual is shaking up the supplement industry with their focus on traceable science and high-quality ingredients. They've got every base covered, from their clinically backed women's 18-plus multivitamin to their stress relief and sleep melatonin, both using first-of-its-kind BioSeries technology designed to optimize formula delivery. For a limited time, get up to 40% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast.
Save big this holiday season! All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.